Thank you, Joe. Can we start out with that little prayer again? God, please help me to set aside everything I think I know about myself, my illness, these steps, and especially you, for an open mind and a new experience with myself, my illness, these steps, and especially you. Amen.
Amen.
You know, the tone of the big book that we talked about a little bit last night, there's absolutely nothing preachy in it. And there's absolutely nothing in it that's arrogant and says, we are the way, and there's no other way with it. You know, no other way to do it. That's the exact opposite of what this book is doing, because this book knows that kind of arrogant presumption is the exact opposite of what we're trying to do, and that it's not effective with people. And I just feel like I wanted to say that I honestly do not know that the big book is the only way to get sober and stay comfortably sober. I doubt very seriously that it is. Bill Wilson and the early founders were quick to say that they hadn't invented a thing. There wasn't a thing new in this book. That all in the world it was using the spiritual principles that were already in place and putting them in a form that we alcoholics could kind of take. So while I don't know that the big book is the only way, and I really am not knocking any other way, I'm truly not knocking religion. The book tells me real specifically that I'm to watch religious people closely, and I'm to listen to what they say, and I'm to be quick to see where they are right. You know, I'm not supposed to look at the religious folks and say, well, my AA is better, you know, blah, 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 and I don't need this, and you better go on to church, save your soul, but you better get your butt back in AA to save your ass. Well, I've said that a whole lot, and I try not to do it in a preachy way, though. So some of the things we're going to talk about, I'm going to be stating them like they're just an absolute fact. But the reason I'm doing that is they have proved to be an absolute fact in my life. So please don't think that I believe I know what's best for any of you guys or anybody else in this universe. I really don't. But all I can do is state what's worked for me. And we already talked about last night, we're going to get into the program of recovery now. And the steps are the only program of recovery. For anybody that's newer, or maybe for some of us that are not so new, the fellowship, the meetings, and having a sponsor, and going to conventions, and going to neat weekends like this, and talking to one another, that's the fellowship. And it's absolutely necessary. We have to have the fellowship, but the function of the fellowship is to support us in doing the steps. Because if we latch on to this fellowship like a leech, without doing the steps, without doing the only program of recovery, depending on us as individuals, we might stay dry for a week, or we might stay dry for 30 years. But we're not going to have any healing of what's really wrong. What we will have done if we latch on to the fellowship and don't do the steps, is it's like going in the hospital if you've got something seriously wrong with you. And folks, if we're alcoholics, we've got something about as serious as it can get wrong with us. And it's like going in the hospital. The fellowship is like the hospital. There are a lot of people, you know, that are caring, that they know how to make you comfortable, and they'll get you comfortable, and you'll feel a whole lot better than you felt before you got in the hospital. But if you've got something really major wrong with you that requires surgery, even though you may feel better for going to the hospital, you're not going to get any better until you have the surgery. You're truly not going to get any better until you have the surgery. And I believe these steps are the surgery. And they're not here. I believe they work on alcoholism, and I was told this early in my sobriety. I believe these steps work on alcoholism just exactly like penicillin works on an infection. And what that means to me is this. If I've got an infection that's going to kill me if I don't do something about it, but it is the type of infection that will respond to penicillin, I don't need to understand my infection. You know, I don't need to have any knowledge at all about what causes my infection. And I don't need to have any knowledge on earth of how penicillin works in the human body to make an infection go away. In fact, I don't even need to believe that that little bottle of penicillin tablets will take care of all these terrible things wrong with magnificent me. And here's the kicker. I don't even need to want to take the tablets. None of that has anything to do with anything. If I've got the infection and I take the tablets as directed, and the folks around me in early sobriety made sure they underscored as directed, if I take the tablets as directed, my infection's going to get just fine. And it's been my experience, fellas, that these steps work on my alcoholism exactly the same way. These steps are not here for me to understand or not understand. They're not here for me to agree with or not agree with, to memorize or not memorize, to want to do or not want to do, to believe they'll work or not believe they'll work. All that's beside the point. These steps are here simply for me to do, for me to follow the instructions. This book says it over and over again. It says we are going to answer the question of what to do specifically. We're going to show others precisely what we have done to recover. Book couldn't be, we're going to give clear-cut directions, and all those are direct quotes from this book. It's going to tell us just precisely what we need to do. The dumbest thing in the big book, and for anybody that's new, that's kind of a cutesy way we have of referring to the Bible without saying the word Bible. But what I thought was the silliest thing in the Bible is a statement that you just absolutely cannot get to the kingdom of heaven unless you come as a little child. And that was just completely nonsensical to me. You know, just the dumbest thing I've ever heard. That's probably the most important quotation from the Bible in my life today. Because if I approach these steps believing that I already know what is wrong with me and that I know what will make me better, I'm not going to get the benefit of this process. Because this isn't a self-help program. If I could have healed myself, I would already have healed myself. Mm-hmm. Any healing that takes place here are going to be because I come to these steps. I come to this process like that little child, and I say, Mom or Dad, I don't know how we got here, and I don't know where we are. And I certainly don't know where we're supposed to go, or I don't know how to get there. But I'm going to trust you. I'm going to put my hand in yours, and I'm just going to take where you take that step. I'm going to step along with you. And I'm going to trust that we're going to go where I need to go. And when I come to these steps that way, when I come to them as a little child, rather than coming to them as an adult that knows all this stuff, well, I knew all that stuff about myself when I was killing myself. Mm-hmm. You know, what I believe I know is what was killing me. So when I come to the steps truly as a little child, that's when it begins to work. And we touched on this last night. None of us are going to learn anything here this weekend that will do us any good at all. However, if we expose to something here this weekend that prompts us to action, the book tells us that we'll be rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence. And I've been blessed by living most of the last 16 and a half years in what to me clearly is a fourth dimension of existence. Just living in a world that I had no idea existed. It's been so wonderful and so many great things involved in it. But it's only from the action It's not from the knowledge. In fact, Cherry Carpenter used to tell me specifically that knowledge without action is not useless. Knowledge without action is worse than useless. Because as long as I don't know what to do, I can muddle and stumble along. But once I know what I need to do and I'm not doing it, then it gets a lot worse. So we're not going to learn anything here this weekend that in and of itself will help a soul. So moving on to the steps. I was sponsored that steps 1 and 2 are different from all the rest of the steps. And the reason that I was told that they are different are that steps 3 through 12 all require action, real specific action that is described precisely in this book. Steps 1 and 2 don't require any action, but rather they require that I reach conclusions. And I must reach those conclusions before I can proceed with the rest of the steps. In fact, this didn't get clear until pretty deep in my sobriety. And I had just read right over this and never given any real thought to what it meant. But the first sentence following what we call the ABCs, in other words, following what we read when we read How It Works, is on page 60. You've got the ABCs there, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives and so on. The next sentence is being convinced we were at step 3. Well, it was years in sobriety before I asked myself, being convinced of what? The steps are not statements of which one would be convinced. Being convinced of what? And it's clear to me now, and clear to folks that sponsor me and I work with, that the reason that that is there is that every word in this book up to that point is devoted to steps 1 and 2. Every word in that book, from the front cover through that, is devoted to helping us reach the conclusions that we have to reach in order to have accomplished steps 1 and steps 2 of the program. When I sponsor folks, what I do, and I suggest this to people, whether they're 24 hours sober or whether they're 20 years sober, when they ask me to sponsor them, I say, hey, let's work through the steps together. You know, let's just do it together. And I ask them if they'll please read the front cover through page 63, and then we'll get together and talk about the conclusions that are steps 1 and 2 and make sure that we have reached those conclusions and are absolutely comfortable with those. And then we'll address step 3. The step 1 conclusions admitted that we were powerless over alcohol is the first one. And that seems like a fairly simple conclusion. But over the years, I found out that that conclusion didn't have anything to do with what I thought it was. I think I mentioned last night that I had intellectually called myself an alcoholic since I was 15 or 16 years old and really hadn't had much doubt in my mind that I was an alcoholic. Don't believe that had a thing to do with the step 1 conclusions at all. by the time I actually began to get exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous, the phenomenon of craving, and you know, the book's real, real clear that this deal we've got, this alcoholism, is a physical allergy to alcohol, which means that once we start drinking, our behavior is not totally predictable, and that at some point this phenomenon of craving will set in on us. And once that deal sets in, then we've got the physical craving for more alcohol when we have alcohol in our body. And that physical allergy is coupled with a mental obsession. And the book also says our problem mainly centers in our mind. So regardless of how powerful that physical allergy has been in my life, and Lord, it's been powerful. The last 2 or 3 years coming off that stuff, it would take 3 or 4 days before I was able to sit up in a chair. And I am absolutely convinced that if I don't drink again, literally on the day that I die, I won't be nearly as sick as I was practically every morning of my life for years. So the physical allergy wasn't any problem with me. And I thought when I got here, I said, well, yeah, you know, these people are right. These people are right. I don't have a problem with that, because once I start drinking this crap, it's awful. You know, it's Katie bar the door. And I just can't get off it by myself. The drive is so strong, that physical drive is so strong, something has to separate me from it. So my solution to that, and I believe this is why they're called steps. See, if I didn't get any further than that, and I didn't, for a lot of those trips to the asylum, and this is the way it would go with me. I'd be in there shaking it out, and I'd think, yeah, they're right. They're right, I'm powerless. Once I get this crap in my system, there's nothing I can do about it, and I can't tell what's going to happen. So, partner, I'll straighten this out. I won't start this cycle over again. Nobody with any sense would, so I've learned my lesson. You know, I won't do that. And it wouldn't be 48 hours at the most by the time I got out of the asylum. And several of the asylums I was in, I would sneak out and go get drunk and come back and pass out literally in the bed of the asylum. Because what was getting me was the mental obsession. See, I knew I was powerless over alcohol after I had taken the first drink. And I thought that meant that, I thought that's what the first step conclusion was. But I was missing that mental obsession that the book tells me is more important even than the physical allergy, and is stronger, that my main problem centers in my mind. And what that mental obsession is that on account of what's wrong with me, this disordered ego, this obsession with myself that I've had all my life that creates all this pain and emptiness inside myself, I will pick up the first drink. The time will come when I have no human defense against it. Bill Wilson does his old trick of telling you the same thing three or four different ways because he wants to make sure you get it. The time's going to come when I don't have any defense against that first drink from any human power. If I'm going to have a defense, it's going to have to come from a power greater than myself. And the only way that I know for an alcoholic to establish a relationship with that power is through these 12 steps. So once I realized that my step one powerlessness wasn't just after I got it in my body, that I wasn't only powerless over step two or over drink two and drink 12, I am powerless over drink one. If I don't do something, if I don't have the surgery that we were talking about, if I don't do something about what's wrong inside me, I am absolutely certain to pick up that first drink, and then the physical allergy will take over and I'll die. Well, you see, I'm getting in a pretty good mess already when I start concluding that. I had some other little conclusions that I had to reach because by the time I began to make my rounds of the sanatoriums and asylums, I was deep into drugs other than alcohol too. So what would happen, they would have me in an asylum and I would basically be in there for drinking the pop-off and the Listerine at that time. And I would be in there shaking it out and going through that hell. And I would think, you know, these people are right. Man, I have just worn it out with alcohol. You know, I've been at it 20-odd years now, and I've done it so I've just worn it out. And I've reached a point where I cannot handle the alcohol. But you know, I'd take a dope, and it doesn't turn me into a raving maniac. You know, I don't wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning after taking some dope feeling like I got to throw a rock through some kind of window to get some more. It just, you know, makes me feel good, calms me down, depending on what time it is. So these folks are right. I've wore it out with this old booze, and I'm done with it. I'll just get out of here and chip on a little dope, and I'll be okay and leave booze alone. And, of course, it wouldn't be 48 hours before I'd be back on everything. Mm-hmm. And then they'd have me in the asylum, bring me off cocaine, Dilaudid, or whatever it was that I happened to be strung out on at that particular time. Mm-hmm. And I'd be in that asylum, and I'd think, you know, I was doing all right till I started messing with this dope. You know, I'd been drinking all my life, and this dope has just complicated everything, and it's messed it up. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to get out of here, and I'm going to leave that damned old dope alone, because it's messed up everything. I'm just going to go back drinking, and I was functioning all right drinking. So I'd get out and I'd go back drinking. It wouldn't be 48 hours before I'd be back on everything that I could find. So I had to expand my conclusion before I could get sober of powerlessness, that I'm powerless not only over alcohol but over all mind-altering drugs, and I'm powerless over them whether or not I've got them in my body. If I don't do something about what's wrong with me, about my inability to be comfortable inside myself, I will pick up the first one. And after I pick up the first one, the physical allergy will take over, and the end result of that physical allergy is real simple. I'm going to live a mad dog life and die a mad dog death. That's quite simply what that powerlessness means. Now, the second, I also had to understand, which this was a tough one for me. This one really liked to kill me. I had to understand that there's a difference between being powerless over alcohol and powerless over my elbow. See, for that 2.5 years that I was in and out of those asylums and in and out of these meetings, I didn't think AA was working because it wasn't making me not want to drink. And I thought if it worked, that that was the way it worked, that it just, you know, kept me from wanting to drink or take dope. And if it didn't keep me from wanting to drink or take dope real bad, then it wasn't working. And, of course, I was powerless over alcohol and mind-altering drugs, so I was just like a little dry leaf blowing around on the wind. You know, it hadn't worked. I wanted to do it, so I had to do it. And I had some sort of idea that if it worked, that either God or you people were going to somehow knock a drink or some dope out of my hand. And that never happened, not one time. Oh, maybe once or twice a disgusted AA somewhere might have taken a drink out of my hand, but not much, and not as a general rule. It turned out that all of my efforts, and what I was trying to do, I was trying to escape responsibility for what I put in my body. I was trying to shift that responsibility to you guys, trying to shift it to a higher power. The bad news on that was that before I could get sober, I had to be prepared one day at a time to do what I'm absolutely convinced were the first mature acts that I'd ever done in 37 years of life. And that was be prepared one day at a time to do some things that I really did not want to do and that I really didn't think would work and that didn't feel good. And I had to be prepared one day at a time to not do some things that I really wanted to do, that I felt like I was going to die if I didn't do it. I can remember in that first couple of months of sobriety, sitting in a room and literally being convinced that if I didn't get something to do something about what was wrong inside, that I was literally going to explode and just splatter all over the ceiling and the walls. And I can remember having been given the gift from God of sitting there saying, all right, damn it, we'll just sit here and see if we explode and blow up, splatter all over the wall. And, you know, I found out, one of the guys in Nashville where I got sober helped me so much with this. As bad as I needed to drink and take the dope, do you know that I don't think the minute ever came when I couldn't have taken it that minute? It got awful bad, but what would cause me to pick it up was my fear of how I was going to feel in 5 minutes or 30 minutes or an hour. That old thing of trying to take care of the future now. And even with God, I found out God doesn't operate on that basis. If I ask God to take care of right now, God will take care of it, no problem, do it every time. But if I get the squirrel cage in about this afternoon at 1 o'clock, or next month, or next year, God is not going to take care of this afternoon, or next month, or next year for me, when I'll just pull in. So the bad news was that for the first 60 days that I was sober, the desire to drink and take dope had not left me. In fact, I don't even know that it had diminished. But the good news is that about 60 days sober, I went out and the pain got so bad that I walked into a liquor store there in Nashville, and as I walked in, I'd been praying for nearly 2 months at that time, So I knew something was working. And I remember as I walked in, I was praying just silently to myself, God, please don't let me drink. God, please don't let me drink. God, please don't let me drink. Give me 2 pints of pawpaw. God, please don't let me drink. Well, I got my 2 pints of pawpaw, and I walked outside that liquor store, and God spoke to me. And incidentally, I tend to agree with Bill Wilson that even though he had a very dramatic spiritual experience, Bill said that if you're out in the woods by yourself and you hear God talking to you, call your sponsor right away. And that's the way it's been with me. God speaks to me through you folks. God speaks to me through my thoughts and feelings, through the literature. But God's never bullhorned me down. But the way that happened, the way God spoke to me, was that it got real clear that if I drank those 2 bottles of vodka, I didn't have any place to go. That I would either proceed on to live that mad dog life and die that mad dog death, which in my case couldn't have been very far away, or somehow I would shake it off one more time, and I'd go dragging back into that same clubhouse in Nashville that I'd dragged back into somewhere between 12 and 50 times, and I don't have any idea which it's closer to, that I'd drag back into the same people where I'd been such an utter and total failure, that I'd have to drag back in there one more time with that incomprehensible demoralization, just incomprehensible demoralization, and say, I did it again. Will you guys tell me one more time? And I just didn't want to do that. God just gave me the gift of not wanting to do that. So I hid that vodka by a stop sign in some weeds across from the liquor store where I could find it just in case this AA deal didn't do something. Because I want to tell you, I mean what I say about that conclusion of the mental obsession. If something doesn't get done about this deal in here, I not only am going to drink, I need to drink and I want to drink. Because I've got to have something to do something about what's wrong inside me. So I went back to the clubhouse, an old boy named Gene Crotch. Gene's dead now, and Gene told me a lot of things that helped me a lot. But Gene said, you know, Don, you've been praying for a couple of months now not to drink and take dope in the morning and praying at night, thanking God. I said, why don't you just invest 15 seconds in the morning and 15 seconds at night and add to that prayer for God to not only get you through the day without drinking and drugging, but if it's His will, to get you through the day without wanting to drink or drug. And then at night, add another 15 seconds to it and thank God for getting you through the day without wanting to drink or drug. And I began to do that. And that has worked every day for over 16 years now. I've always done it this morning and now on my knees in that cabin, and I'm going to do it tonight too, Lord willing, and I hope that I do it tomorrow, because see, I don't think I've had a thing removed in the way of obsession to drink. I think that obsession to drink is sitting right there 16 and a half years bigger, meaner, and thirstier than it was the last time I checked on it. But I've got to do my daily maintenance of my spiritual condition to get my reprieve. So I had to understand that stopping drinking wasn't God's business, and it really wasn't y'all's business. Stopping drinking was my business, and I had to do it. I had to do the first mature acts I'd ever done in my life. Now, the second conclusion involved in step one, see, I've already taken this first conclusion that I'm powerless over alcohol and mind-altering drugs, and I'm powerless over them whether I've got them in my system or not. I'm going to pick them up. And the second conclusion is that my life has become unmanageable. Well, I got to exposure to the program, and I didn't have a bit of problem with that, folks, because by the time I got here, there was absolutely no argument that my life was a total mess. Absolute total mess. And there was absolute no argument, no doubt in my mind that nobody could have managed more poorly than I had managed. I had managed just absolutely as bad as a human being could manage. So I thought, well, my life's unmanageable. There's no question about it. Guys, I hadn't even begun to address first step unmanageability when I had reached those conclusions. Because you see, if my life is a mess because I have managed terribly, what in the world do I need with step two? What I need to be doing looking around here for some sort of vague higher power, a metaphysical thing to intercede in my life. If my life's a mess because I've managed terribly, all I need to do is manage better, by George. Grab that sucker by the horns and just bear down and manage better. Well, the way it developed over the over a period of time, and the best example for me that I've ever been aware of is to use a car as my example. Back at the boat dock, I've got a car parked. And that car, well, let's put it this way. If I'm having problems, big problems, driving that car, you know, I keep running over people, I keep breaking the car, I keep getting speeding tickets, keep having wrecks, then if that's my problem, there are a lot of things that I can do. I can pay more attention to my driving. I can go to driving schools. There's a lot of things that I can do if my problem is that my driving is a mess because I am driving so poorly. On the other hand, guys, if that car sitting up there is undrivable, unmanageable. If that car is undrivable, it doesn't make any difference how much attention I pay to it. And I can go to every advanced driving school in the country, I ain't going an inch. Because that's not the problem. The problem is the car is undrivable, and that's what our step says, is the life is unmanageable. And when I really accept that conclusion, what I'm concluding is, yes, my life is a terrible mess, and I could not have prevented it on my own. With what's wrong with me, I was absolutely unable to prevent my life getting in the awful mess that it's in. And because my life is unmanageable, just like the car is undrivable, I can't do a single thing on my own about cleaning up this awful mess that I've got in my life. Now, when I've reached those conclusions, when I've concluded that I'm powerless over booze and dope, whether I've got them in my body or not, that if I don't do something to get some help for the way I feel inside myself, I'll pick up the first one, and then that physical allergy will take over, and I'll die that mad dog death, and that my life is this terrible mess that I couldn't have even prevented, and on my own, I can't do a single thing, and no human power can do a single thing about cleaning that sucker up because we can't manage it. It's unmanageable. Then, fellas, then and only then, am I in that absolutely impossible dilemma that is step one. And step one has got to be an absolute impossible dilemma. If we are thinking that we can manage better and take care of step one, or that somehow we can keep on our own from taking that first drink, we haven't taken step one. And particularly for those of us of an agnostic temperament, hard-headed, we are not going to turn to step three because we hadn't built, or step two, because we haven't built the foundation on which step two has got to rest. And believe me, I was dragged kicking and screaming to it. It wasn't until I had accepted the conclusions that made it absolutely, absolutely that impossible for me and that hopeless for me that I was willing to begin to be willing to act like that there might be a power greater than myself out there somewhere that could do something about my life. So having reached those step one conclusions, I came to the step two conclusions, and those are a little simpler. You know, step two doesn't involve a conclusion that there's a God as we think of God. It doesn't involve a conclusion that there's any power in this universe that has got any interest whatsoever in intervening in our lives. The first conclusion in step two simply involves opening the door a little bit to the idea, you know, the step is came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Not would, not was willing to, not was waiting, you know, hopefully by the door of our heart ready to do it, but just opening the door a little bit that, yes, I have no place to go. I've reached these conclusions in step one, and I am humanly absolutely hopeless. There is no place for me to go. Then I conclude that just maybe there's some power in this universe that can help me with those impossible dilemmas that I'm in on kind of step one, that that has got the power. Not that it will. All I've got to do is open that door. And the way the door opening happened with me didn't have much to do with the changing of thoughts, feelings, and beliefs. In telling my story last night, I told you a little bit about the way it happened with me. In my sobriety, it has become real clear to me that the only effective barometer of my willingness is whether I'm doing it or not. I can tell you I'm willing to do something about something all I want to, and I can be intellectually convinced I'm doing, you know, I'm willing to do something about it. But if I am not doing it, I don't believe I'm really willing. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I can have all kinds of mental reservations. I cannot want to do it. I cannot believe it'll work. I can feel just as resentful as hell about being told to do it. But if I am doing it, I am willing. And by that definition of willingness, when I started getting down on my knees morning and night and saying words that I didn't believe were being heard by anything to a power that I didn't believe was even out there with any interest in my life or any willingness to intervene, because, see, I hadn't gone through life as an atheist. I always had some sort of intellectual theory about creation, but the concept that I couldn't handle, and it was just that old ego, I couldn't handle the concept that was that there was any power greater than my brain as far as actually running the minutes and the hours of every day of my life. And I believe that's probably a pretty good definition of what my religious friends today call a personal God. In other words, I could accept the idea of some sort of impersonal creator of the universe, or, you know, order of the universe, but by George, wasn't anything greater than my little old brain as far as actually running the hours and the minutes and the days of my life. So my brain vetoed absolutely the idea of a personal God. But I started getting down on those knees anyway, and the miracle of the second step happened to me. Now, the second conclusion in step one, has to do with sanity and insanity. And when you read that, if I've got to be restored to sanity, then I necessarily must have concluded that I have been insane. Now, we mentioned last night that I was told in an asylum one time that they didn't put me in that asylum for being crazy, but for acting crazy. And they wouldn't let me out for being sane, but for acting sane. When I read this book, when they are talking about sanity and insanity, they are not talking about a state of mind. They're talking about behavior. And when somebody is acting insane, they are characterized as insane. And when somebody is acting sanely, they are characterized as sane. And I want to tell you, fellas, if I had not been given the gift of learning that I do not have to feel sane to act sane, God knows where I'd be. Because my whole life, there are still days today when I'm absolutely convinced, just as crazy as a June bug. Truly crazy. But I've learned that if I don't act crazy, I can tell, you know, it isn't that a stuff, I will usually tell, you know, one of my AA buddies or a sponsor or something, say, you know, I'm real crazy today, and most of them think like I do and believe like I do, and they say, well, you know, I won't hurt anything, Don, just don't act crazy. Because, see, being crazy won't hurt you. And if you don't act crazy and walk on through that, it real soon gets funny that we were crazy. You know, we laugh about that. Oh, I was crazy as hell last Tuesday, you know, but I didn't act crazy, didn't hurt anything, so no big deal, that's funny, but you let me act crazy. And sometimes it don't ever get funny. And it usually takes a long, long time for it to get funny, if it even gets funny, because it's acting crazy. That'll kill me just like a bullet. So what that step, as I read the book, is concluding simply that I have acted insanely. And I don't know how a person could get here. I don't know why a person would even consider going to an AA meeting if they had not acted insanely, if they had not acted in a way that was not in their own best interest. So I don't have a bit of trouble with the insanity conclusion. Book tells us a lot of neat things. It says that when we get to the second step, that it seems like the flimsiest of reads, because we've exhausted everything in those step one conclusions. We don't have any place to go, and even though we've got this flimsy read of just this possibility that there's something metaphysical out there in this universe that can give us a chance to live, but it tells us that what appeared to be a flimsy reed was in fact the powerful hand of God. And it worked just exactly that way with me. The praying is something that I think I mentioned last night. I've never missed a morning or night, to the best of my knowledge, doing that. And I also know that I told you that it still doesn't feel good a lot of times. And I don't want to do it all the time. I do need to tell y'all this. When I was about, I expect 90 days sober, I went to Cherry Carpenter and I said, "Cherry, this is not working. This is not working, partner." I said, I get down on my knees and I try to say those prayers, and I'm so scared and my brain's spinning so much I can't remember the last word that I just prayed, and it doesn't feel like it's getting beyond the walls, and then I try to read my meditation books, and Cherry, I can't remember the last word I read a lot of times. Not just a matter of not being able to remember the whole thing, I mean, I can't retain any of it, so it's not working. And Cherry basically said, he said, "Don, you are the most arrogant little SOB that I've ever known." He said, "Let's examine what you're talking about here." He said, "In the first place, you're saying it's not working. You've been sober about 8 times longer than you have ever been since you were 12 or 13 years old. So something's working." But he said, "Let's examine your idea that you're praying and your morning reading is not working." He said, "Are you under the impression that God is unaware of your needs, and if you don't get your thoughts together and state them just precisely right, that God won't know what you need? Do you think God's up there wringing his hands thinking, 'Oh, my Lord, I hope Don gets it right. You know, I hope he gives me the proper list of what he needs.'" He said, "Don, God doesn't need your help in advising him of your needs. God knows your needs a lot better than you do." He said, "But in your case, I think it's worse than that." He said, "In your case, I think you believe that you ought to be able to state your prayer and make your case so eloquently to God that you will impress God into giving you what you want." And he said, "Now let's look at this reading deal." He said, "Don, haven't we already been through the fact that you can't learn anything that'll keep you sober? Haven't you gotten past the idea that you're supposed to save yourself by your intellect here some sort of way?" He said, "No, Don." He said, "The only thing of your prayer that is of any real value is your willingness to get down on those knees and humble yourself before your God and try to pray." He said, "That is the value. God doesn't need to be advised what you need, and you're not going to impress God with your eloquence. So the only thing that's any value is that act of prayer." Said, "With regard to that reading, the only thing that's of any value is your willingness to open those books up and look at that page and try to read it." He said, "You will get just as much spiritual value out of doing that as you would if you thought you intellectually understood and absolutely retained every word." He said, "Your intellect is not going to save you. your intellect. And at this stage, and of course I was real early in sobriety, my intellect was still my enemy. Cherry told me later on that our intellect, when we finally round the corner, and step 10 is where we'll talk about that, our intellect becomes our friend again, and we become able to exercise our strong wills all we want to again. Those things that have been our impediments, that have been in our way, been our biggest stumbling blocks, become our friends again. But that strong will and those intellects, they kill an awful lot of us. They almost killed me early on. Why don't we take a 5-minute break before we go to step 3? Can we do that? We've talked about these conclusions. We've gotten ourselves in an absolutely humanly hopeless mess with step 1 conclusions. And if we haven't done that, we haven't reached our step 1 conclusions. If we're still thinking that maybe if we manage better that we'll be all right, or that some human power can help us out of the ditch we've gotten ourselves in, or that working on our managing skills and paying more attention to it is the solution, then I don't believe we've reached that conclusion. But when we've reached that conclusion, step 1, that's when we're at the jumping off place. That's when we don't have any place to go, and that's when the hardest cases of us on the spiritual thing. And see, you can be a hard case spiritually all sorts of different ways. There's the intellectually arrogant horse's butt like me. Then there are the folks who can feel like that they are so well versed in religion that they almost insulted that this, you know, book would be talking to them, telling them they need to start over on reestablishing a contact with God, and they need to do it another way. There are all sorts of arrogance that can and do play in that on us. But once we've reached those conclusions, and then we've been willing finally, however thinly our willingness is, but when we've said, hey, I'm going to die and nothing human can help me, so the only shot I've got is something to do with a higher power. And if we've already had a higher power, or thought we have all of our life, and maybe well-versed in religion, then that conclusion is, maybe I've got to lay aside everything I think I know about it. Maybe I've got to lay aside all of it. And the agnostic has to lay aside everything that he thinks he doesn't know about it, and willing to just take the actions and go on with step 2. And that's when that flimsy reed turns into the strong hand of God. But once we've done 1 and 2, and y'all have probably heard that the way you can state the first 3 steps real simply is, number 1 is I can't, number 2 is he can, and number 3 is I think I'll let him. So we're ready to begin the action. Like the book says there on page 60, being convinced, we were at step 3. And to me, that's real clear. It means that we are convinced of the conclusions that we've talked about this morning. And then and only then are we ready for step 3. This is the beginning of the action steps. Step 3 is not a philosophical step. Step 3 does not turn a single thing over to God. And I had that so mixed up. After I'd prayed for a few months and it was getting clear that something was working, I started to try to impress Cherry Carpenter with my newfound spirituality. And that turned out to be a mistake. But I would go to Cherry and think I was going to be like Jesus in the temple when he was 12, you know, and astounding the wise men, now that I'd turned my great intellect and vast experience to spirituality. And I'd start talking to Cherry about this magnificent deal that was going to be my 3rd step. Lord, turning Don Major's life and will over to God, it was going to be kind of like one of those old Cecil B. DeMille movies, you know, with trumpets blaring and everything. And the way I kind of had it pictured was God and I'd go in this big long hall, and God would unroll the entire tapestry of my whole life all the way out. And God and I'd walk up and down that and examine God's will, and I'd point out a few things, and God'd say, gee, no, I never thought of that. Yeah, we'll do it. But at any rate, we would get God's will mapped out for the rest of my life, and then I could go on spiritual cruise control. Well, I started explaining all this to God, to Cherry, and about the complexity, and made an awful mistake one day. I had been working on the third step, and I made an awful mistake. I told Cherry I didn't know whether I had done the third step or not, and he said, I do. He said, anytime you're sitting around a discussion meeting, Don, and hear somebody wondering whether they've done the third step in Alcoholics Anonymous or not, said, don't worry about it. They clearly have not done it. Because, said, the third step is not some sort of philosophical transformation. The third step is a series of specific actions that are described on pages 62 and 63 of this book with at least as much specificity as any of the rest of the action steps. The action steps being everything 3 through 12. And he said, if a person, he said, by the way, this book, Don, was written, the purpose in writing this book was to experiment with whether or not the message of Alcoholics Anonymous could be carried by mail. That was the purpose of writing this book. This book was specifically written with the idea that it would wind up in the hands of what we call loners. People who had this book and no actual contact with anybody else that was involved in recovery. And he said, Don, that is why, on page 63, it says, it says that it's more desirable to do our third step with an understanding person, but that if no understanding person is available, it's better to meet God alone than not at all, so we can do it by ourselves. He said, for every one of us, we've got rooms full of understanding people. Said, for us, it means that if we haven't reached the conclusions, made the decisions, different from reaching conclusions, it's making decisions, which requires some action. If we haven't made the decisions that are involved in step three, and if we haven't intended for it to be a watershed moment in our lives when we tried to stop doing things our way and we tried to start doing them God's way, and if we haven't gone into a room with an understanding person, gotten on our knees, and said words very similar to those on page 63, we have not done the third step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, furthermore, if you not only if you hear somebody wondering whether they have done the third step, have they not done it? If somebody doesn't know when and where and with whom they did the third step of Alcoholics Anonymous, they pretty clearly have not done it. Very unlikely if they actually did it that they will forget when and where and with whom. Because we always have an understanding person available today. And then he said, Don, this seems so complicated to you. And he said, I want to be real careful not to insult your intellect, but why don't you paraphrase the third step for me? He said, and please don't quote it. God knows. I know you can quote it. But tell me what the third step is. And I said, well, it's turning my will in life over to God. And he said, no, doesn't have a thing in the world to do with that. He said, it's making a decision to turn our will in life over to the care of God. And I said, oh, come on, Cherry, you're splitting hairs with me. You know, you're talking about semantics, for goodness sakes. And Cherry cleared his throat, put a little tobacco in his mouth, and he said, Don, this is always terribly hard for me, but I'm going to try to get up on your intellectual level. And he said, Don, if there are three frogs sitting on the wall and one decides to jump in the pond, how many are left? And I said, two. And he said, no, dumbass, three. He just decided. He hadn't gone anywhere. He's not gone until he actually jumps. And then Cherry explained to me that I can decide right now that I'm going to New York when this retreat is over tomorrow, and I can really make that decision. No reservations. Share it with every one of you guys, and I have made that decision. I won't get across the Ohio River unless after making that decision I do a whole series of specific organized acts that will implement and give my decision reality. So Cherry said, no, Don, the third step doesn't turn one single thing over to God. And with regard to that whole tapestry of my life and getting zeroed in on God's will for the rest of my life and going on cruise control, when we were talking about the third step, Cherry said, Don, you are never in this life going to have any glimpse, not any glimpse. He made it clear that he wasn't talking about a clearer understanding of it. He was talking about any glimpse. Said, you are never going to have any glimpse of God's will except in the right now. Said, and said further, the only glimpse of God's will you will ever get in the right now is for what the next right action for you is. He said, I'm not telling you that you can't be sorry about all the starving children in India, but I'll tell you that God's will for that, God's where God's will works in with crippled children, where God's will works with these 35 alcoholics dying and this one 36th one being sitting around this table this morning, is none of your business, and your attempts to understand it are just exactly like a chimpanzee trying to understand quantum physics. And said, you are not going to get any, all you're going to do is drive yourself crazy and get bitter. Said, anytime you think you've got any inkling of what God's will is for another human being at any time, call me because you're nuts. And he said, anytime you think you've got any inkling of what God's will for you 5 minutes from now or next Tuesday or next year is, call me because you're just as nuts. And then he explained to me, just putting it in any context, and this is true wherever we are. We all believe that it'll probably be God's will for us to be sitting here doing this 30 seconds from now. Any one of us could keel over with a heart attack. Boat could start sinking. Boat could blow up. Could be a nuclear attack. We could go on for 30 minutes about the things that could happen that would totally change what we think is going to be God's will for us 5 seconds from now. So Cherry said, if you'll just pull in, he said, this is what the book is telling us. First place, the 3.5 pages that it talks about the third step here, it refers to the word self in one form or the other 21 times by my count, if I counted them right. And this is where it tells us real clearly selfishness, self-centeredness. That's on page 62. That, we think, is the root of our troubles. And that's where Cherry got it, that the first thing wrong with us is that disordered ego. If you just think about that, if selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my troubles, then nothing can be wrong with me first except a disordered ego. That's the root. And everything else has grown from that. All these things that we call alcoholism and all the problems that I've had in my life, everything that's cut me off from good, that's cut me off from God, that's cut me off from my fellow man, has been my selfishness and my self-centeredness. Further tells me that I get to looking at that and that this self-centeredness is absolutely going to kill me unless I do something about it. And then it goes on to tell me, gets me another dilemma here. It tells me that even though the self-centeredness is going to kill me, I can't do much about it. That I'm powerless over that self-centeredness. I can't get rid of it. I can't wish it away. I can't pray it away. I may have moral and philosophical convictions galore, but I can't live up to them. I'm just in an awful mess. And then the book goes into its clear instruction manual mode. It says, we had to have God's help. This is the how and why of it. Going to tell us just precisely what the first 100 folks did when they had reached those conclusions that were steps 1 and 2 and were approaching step 3. And this is how they got God's help, Cherry told me. said, first of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. He said, that's simple, Don. And this is another one of these examples where Bill Wilson really is going to tell us the same thing three or four different ways to make sure we get the point, because it was such an important point. Said, Don, as long as you're trying to look at God's will beyond the instant or beyond what God's will for your next action is, said, you're playing God, because the patterns of life are none of your business. And he pointed out that I'd spent my whole life looking around at the patterns and trying to figure them out, trying to see where we were coming from and where we were going and how we needed to get there and maybe how I needed to change the pattern. And he pointed out that I had never seen one single pattern correctly. And I still haven't. And I still keep wasting my time and, you know, getting my focus off what I'm supposed to be doing by looking around the patterns and playing God. Playing God. And I'm right back in that deal we were talking about. I'm like the chimpanzee trying to do quantum physics. I'm just way, way over my head. And it isn't until I pull back into the moment and I do the stitching. See, the patterns are God's job, and the stitching's mine. Not only will God not share the patterns with me and discuss the patterns with me and get my input on them and my approval, God's not going to do that. God just tends to the patterns. God's not going to stitch for me either. Mm-hmm. I've got to do the stitching. Now, the good news, Terry told me, and this has been so important to me, is that if I'll be still and know that he's God. And I've got a picture in my mind that I got in an asylum one time. A counselor by the name of Marlene in this asylum had this picture in her mind of her in God's hands and her just having a fit, you know, all scared and jumping up and down. God saying, Carlene, now just calm down, Carlene. How can I help you with you acting such a fool? Now just calm down, Carlene. You know, just calm down. You know, I'll take care of everything. Just, I can't help you with you acting like this. You just calm down. So Cherry says that if I'll calm down and if I'll listen, if I'll quit worrying about the patterns and quit playing God, that God will always tell me precisely where to take the next stitch. And I believe that that's exactly true. See, when I get confused is when I get to worrying about how the next stitch relates to the pattern 5 minutes or 5 years down the road, which ain't none of my business anyway. But it's always pretty darn clear. You know, it's never been the next right thing for me to tell a lie. Never been the next right thing for me to steal. But, you know, if I get to think about all the ramifications and that sort of thing and hurting people's feelings and what can happen, I can confuse myself to the point where it seems like the next right thing for me to lie or steal. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, usually that's always been true of me, that when I lie, it never really seems like I'm lying because it doesn't feel like it sounds when you lie. You know, I've got such good reasons for lying, and I'm frequently doing it for your own good. Mm-hmm. You know, So it doesn't feel like lying because it doesn't sound like it sounds when you lie. And when I steal, God, I've got good reasons for doing it. I mean, usually it's my right or I need so badly that it doesn't feel a thing like it looks when you steal. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got such good reasons for it. So Cherry said, when I will pull in and pull into the moment and just concern myself with the stitch, that God will tell me just precisely where to stitch. When I quit playing God, leave the patterns to God, and I do the stitch. And he went on to tell me, which we'll talk about in the later steps, that when I do that, the pattern that God has got in mind for me is invariably far more beautiful than anything that I would have dared hope for. I'm not even capable of picturing the patterns that my God has got in mind for me when I'll pull into my job and do the stitching and leave the pattern to my God. Then Bill backs that up by saying, next we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. And Cherry explained to me, that's real simple, it's kind of a restatement of the same thing. If I'm going to be in a play, the director will give me a script. And that script will have all of the words that my character is supposed to say, what my character is supposed to do on stage, where my character is supposed to move. If I get that script and get the reading saying, no, this is wrong. This is wrong. If my character says this, it won't come off well at all. My character won't get the attention that it needs, and it won't get the point across that needs to get across. God, that's the whole point of the play that'll be missed there. And if my character moves this way, it won't be appropriate. It'll detract from the play. So I'm not going to say these words. I'm going to say what I think's better, and I'm going to move where I think the character ought to move. If I do that, I will have chaos until I follow the script, because the director is in charge of that play. And I just quite simply will have chaos until, despite the fact that I'm convinced that it's not the right thing and I'm scared to death that my character and the whole play will be a failure, until I start following the script, I will have no peace. And Cherry made it clear to me that that script is that still small voice, conscience, whatever you want to call it, that little spark of the divine in me that if I'll truly pull into the now, will tell me without fail what the next right thing for me to do is. And he explained to me about the next right thing. He said, Don, you know, I'm sure you're sitting there thinking that the enemy of the next right thing, the things that will make you not want to do the next right thing, will usually be things like greed and lust. And I said, well, yeah, you know, what else would it be? And he said, it'll be greed and lust and things like that maybe 1% of the time. But he said, Don, 99% of the time, the enemy of the right thing will be your fear. Mm-hmm. Your fear that if you take that next stitch where your heart is telling you the next stitch should be taken, that the pattern won't work out right, that you'll lose something that you don't want to lose, or you won't get something that you feel like you need so badly. So he said, the face, the mask that yourself will wear, 99% of the time will be fear. Said the greed and lust are there, and they'll be for a very small percentage of the time, but fear is going to be the real enemy. Then he pointed out to me, the book says, he is the principal, we are his agents. He said, that's just employee. Said, Don, if you're working for a guy and he drives you out early in the morning, drops you off, says, Don, I want 3 holes dug across that line right there. I want them dug 18 inches deep, 1 foot in diameter and 2 feet apart, and I'll be back at lunch and pick you up. That guy gets in his truck and heads out. I get to looking. That's not where those holes ought to be. I know what he's trying to do here, and these holes don't need to be there. Besides, ground's too rocky over there. And these holes don't need to be 18 inches deep. They need to be 24 inches deep. And they don't need to be 2 feet apart. They need to be 3 feet apart. And I go on, and I start acting on what I have decided is better. When that man comes back at noon, I'm going to have chaos. And I'm going to continue to have chaos until I follow the boss's orders. Because he is the boss. And there's no way I can have peace. There's no way I can avoid chaos until I start listening to that little small voice and doing that next right thing, although I can't see the pattern and I'm scared to death that if I do it, it won't work out right. Then Bill repeats it one more time, says, he is the father and we are his children. Kid won't eat the spinach. Kid just absolutely is not going to eat the spinach. Well, if the parent is firm, and folks, our Heavenly Father is always firm. I mean, God, in all of God's wonderful forgiveness and love, God plays hardball. God is pretty entrenched in God's positions. It doesn't change a whole lot. And if the kid is not going to eat the spinach and the parent is firm, the kid will have chaos. The kid may not ever get to where he likes spinach, and the kid may not believe that spinach is good for him, but the kid can stop the chaos and get some peace by agreeing to follow the parent's orders and eat the spinach. Kid doesn't have to change his mind about spinach, just like how the employee doesn't have to change his mind about where those holes ought to be. The actor doesn't have to change his mind about what would be better for the play. But if they're going to avoid chaos, they're going to have to do that next right thing instead of letting the fear and the self-will take over and doing what they need to do or want to do. And it says, most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arc through which we passed to freedom. You know, that's quite a statement. I didn't know what keystone was. I thought I did. I thought it had something to do with cornerstone or base, and keystone is actually the top stones in an arch that are milled so that they slide fit together and it holds the whole arch together. So Bill's telling us that this is absolutely the thing that holds it all together, is knowing that we are to do that next right thing and that we know inside of us, and we'd stay in the moment rather than trying to figure out the pattern, trying to figure it all out ourselves. It's really just another way of saying come to it as a little child. If I keep insisting that I know how it's going to work, if I keep trying to be a chimpanzee fooling with quantum physics, I'm going to have nothing but chaos. It isn't until I pull it in and I'm a child. I'm the actor, not the director. I'm the employee, not the employer. That's the only way I can get the peace. That's the only way I can avoid the chaos. Well, after Cherry had convinced me that the step does in fact say that it's just a decision, that it doesn't involve turning my life and will over to God, I thought I still knew where the complication was. Because I'm telling you, it was insulting that Don Major's third step was that simple. It just seemed like that it ought to be more to it than that, you know. So I said, okay, Cherry, you've made your point on the little decision thing. But I still know where the complexity is. Once I've decided to turn my will and life over to the care of God, how do I implement that decision? You know, if I decide to go to New York, I know how to implement that decision. So once I've decided, how do I implement it? And I just knew that's where the complexity was. Cherry says, that's just as simple. Just as simple. Said, all you are deciding to do when you get on your knees in that room with an understanding person, say those words that are similar to page 63, all you are deciding to do is do the next right thing instead of what you want to do, and to do the rest of these steps. And said, if you will do that, you won't have to sit around discussion meetings or worry your sponsor with wondering about what God's will for your life and will is, because God will make your life and will into what God wants your life and will to be. Said it's just that simple. All you are deciding to do is, number one, the rest of the steps, and do the next right thing instead of what you want to do. And he went on to tell me some things that really surprised me. He said in the same conversation, he said, Don, the only definition of courage is doing the next right thing when you don't want to do it. And I knew I was far better educated and better read than Cherry, so what I really thought was, well, Cherry just doesn't understand how many definitions of courage there are. I want to tell you, for me, there is no courage. See, if it's not the right thing, it doesn't even address courage. And if I want to do it, it doesn't take any courage. So the only time that courage is in my life is when I'm doing that next right thing when I don't want to do it. Also told me something that, you know, the prayer asks God to relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do God's will. I was kind of shocked at what the bondage of self is. The bondage of self turned out to be my health, my child, my relationship, my job, my money, my house, my car, my reputation in Alcoholics Anonymous. All those things are just precisely the bondage of self. And until I'm willing to not be in bondage to them anymore, and to make it the first thing in my life to follow my director, to follow my boss, to follow my father, and do that next right thing, and I'm willing to lay all those things on the table and say, Dad, there's some things here that I sure do prefer to keep, because I have my preferences. But I can't have demands and make it work. Tell them willing to lay those things on the table and say, God, there's some things here I'd sure prefer to keep. I'd sure prefer to keep my health, and I'd sure prefer to keep my daughter, and I'd sure prefer to be able to eat next week and that sort of thing, and to keep my house, and I'd prefer to stay out of the penitentiary. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to demand it. I'm going to lay it right here, and I'm going to do that next step, and I'm going to leave all that up to you, and I'm just going to trust that it's going to work out. When I became willing to do that, it began to work better. Now, one more quick thing before we talk about the third step promises a little bit. The origin of the word sponsor is connected with the third step. Did you ever think that the word sponsor isn't mentioned in the first 164 pages of this book? It's just not in there. And you ever think about the word sponsor? It doesn't make a bit of sense in the world. A sponsor is somebody that pays for the airtime, or somebody that buys the uniforms for the softball team, or maybe in an exclusive club is somebody that says, I know old so-and-so, he's blue-blooded enough and got enough money, and I'll sponsor him, I'll vouch for him. But kind of half-baked spiritual advisor, sponsor, you know, where in the world we get that? Well, where we got it was from what we now call the third step. In the very beginning, before this book was written, see, this book was written in the late 30s, the fellowship had started in 35. And we didn't have the 12 steps until this book was written. In fact, fellowship didn't have a name until this book was written. The fellowship was named after the book, not the other way around. They were considering names like the Way Out and that sort of thing. But they had all the principles that were in the 12 steps. They just didn't have them set down in 12 steps. And the way the word sponsor came into the vocabulary is that in the very early days, when one of the folks that was already in the outfit here found a bad drunk out here somewhere, that person would go and begin to first listen to and then talk to that bad drunk, because, fellas, I got to tell you something. If there's a single one of you guys that I won't listen to, I absolutely cannot effectively tell you or show you one thing. The first law of me being able to help anybody is my willingness to listen to them. So they would go out and first listen to this guy, and then they would begin to talk to this guy about their own experience. If this guy reached the conclusions that we now call steps one and steps two, and became willing to reach for that flimsy reed because he felt like he couldn't go anywhere else, and was willing to go into a room with the guy that was already in the little group of six or eight or whatever it was, if he was willing to go into a room with that one fellow and get on his knees and say words just real similar to these on page 63 that we call the third step prayer, then and only then would he be taken to his first meeting. Because the importance that they put on it was that if you weren't willing to reach those conclusions and weren't willing to get on your knees and do what we now today call the third step, it wasn't a bit of sense in wasting time with your raggedy butt, because you wasn't going to make it. They wouldn't take you to a meeting. But once you had done that, they'd walk you in there into that first meeting after you had done what we call the first two, three steps, and they would say, here's old Chuck, I've been working with him, and I believe he's ready, I'll sponsor him. And that's how the word sponsor came into the vocabulary of the program, is that if somebody was willing to do these first three steps, then they'd let them come to a meeting because they thought it would do some good. But if they weren't willing to do it, they wouldn't waste time letting them come to it. They had more serious things to work with. The third step promises, and everybody that's got a book, we have some sort of way institutionalized the promises that are referred to in the eighth and ninth step and call them the promises, and of course they're just a small percentage of the promises, and as far as I'm concerned, the third step promises are probably the most powerful and beautiful ones in the book. When we're willing to do this simple thing, when we're willing to have this watershed moment, make a decision not turn a thing over to God, but make a decision to set out on this path of the rest of the steps and doing the next right thing that will turn our will and lives over to God. This tells us what happened. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. And see, it's just talking real clearly about my stitching, about my following the boss's orders, about my following the script. If I do that, my God will provide what I need. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we've been, see, referring right back to our patterns, right back to the patterns that are God's job. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life, as we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully. As we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. Mm-hmm. Now, how can you get any stronger promise than that? Mm-hmm. Have all of your needs provided, to lose your fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter, to actually be reborn. We're talking about rebirth here. We're not talking about intellectual or spiritual enhancement. We're talking about rebirth. And as far as I'm concerned, those are as strong as any promises in this book. As I was getting ready to leave from having done the third step with Cherry, Cherry caught me as I was about the time I got to the door, and I'm going to close with this, and we'll take a break, come back and talk about 4 and 5 for a while. But as I got to the door, Cherry said, "By the way, Don," I said, "have you read over on the top of the next page or on top of page 64? And, of course, I'd read the whole big book several times. Quite a big book scholar at that point. And I said, "Yeah, I've read it." He said, "Well, let me point out something in case you missed it." He says that what we have just done here, the book tells us right on top of page 64, it says, "Though our decision was a vital and crucial step," and that's talking about that third step decision, because that's all the third step is that decision, "it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face so and so forth. Therefore, we were at step 4. He said, "Now, Don, you're going to sit around with your buddies in discussion meetings, and you're going to hear them say, 'You don't want to do that fourth step too quick, you might get drunk.' And you're going to hear them say, 'Your group will let you know when you're ready for a fourth step.' And then," he said, "you're going to hear the theory, it'd be kind of like seeing a burning bush. You'll just know when you're ready to do a fourth step. Then you'll hear, well, your sponsor will tell you when to do it." He said, "I want you to be aware that this is another promise in this book, that even though all those theories may be fine, that the book says that your third step won't amount to a hill of beans, that it will evaporate unless you begin a fourth step at once. Not when you see a burning bush, not when your group tells you you're ready." It was about that time that he explained to me that Dr. Bob was running around Akron doing amends on the afternoon after he had his last beer that morning. Now, he wasn't telling me fly through these steps and don't pay any attention to them, but he was telling me that this is not something that we need to procrastinate, and it's not this idea of, "Oh, I'm going to let steps work me." I don't think so. You know, these are action things that we have to get in here, and we have to follow these instructions and create that environment where God can do the miracle of recovery. But at any rate, what he wound up telling me, he said, "Don, what this means to you is that if you haven't begun your fourth step, don't call me and aggravate me about feeling like your third step has evaporated. And don't call me and complain about turning things over to God and then bouncing back in your lap," because that is the promise. The promise is that just precisely that will happen unless your third step is followed at once by a fourth step. So let's break, and then we'll come back and talk about the fourth step as far as I'm concerned, unless we got any discussion that anybody wants to bounce around.